From KCRW, I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food. I cannot believe that you wrote this book.
I can't believe that I had an unknown fan in you. I'm very excited about that.
I'm talking to screenwriter and home cook Sri Rao about his new book. It's called Bollywood Kitchen, home-cooked Indian recipes paired with unforgettable Bollywood films.
I really think anyone who loves the sensual sensory overload that Indian food sometimes is will enjoy some aspect of Bollywood.
I'm one of these people who loves watching international movies. I guess I am a voyeur at heart, not just of food, but of just daily life and culture in other parts of the world. And Bollywood movies gives you that, like, just writ large.
Oh, absolutely, right? They are larger than life. They are a spectacle of color and emotions and drama and music. They're really fantastic.
And you kind of have to learn to surrender to them because some of them are really long.
Yes, they can be. They are getting shorter now, but historically, yes, they've been easily over 3 hours.
And there's always a ton of food in them.
Of course, because Indians love their food just as much as they love their movies.
Tell me a little bit about the role of the Indian movie industry in an expat Indian's life. When someone emigrates and you're far from home, even though they may find a community that comes from even the same town they come from, there must be a role that Bollywood movies play that's so important.
Absolutely. I mean, the first thing to understand is that films for all Indians, particularly in India, is a way of life. I know that we here in America think that we're really crazed with Hollywood and our movies from Hollywood go all around the world, and that is absolutely true. But we haven't seen anything compared to Indians and how much they love their films. Films really are like a religion there, literally, so much so that some of the very popular actors are revered as though they were demigods in small towns and villages across India. You know, traditionally, many Indians are lower income. You know, hundreds of millions of people live under the poverty line in India. And movies for them are their only sense of escape, you know, a way that they can transport themselves to a fantasy world where they see people and places that they might not otherwise experience in their lives. And so it's not just for poorer people, but for all strata of society in India, films are a primary form of entertainment in that country. And so for people who came to America, like my parents did in the 60s, they brought that tradition with them. And when we talk about the role of Indian cinema in Indian Americans' lives, there's another layer that is added onto it. So not only, you know, are we Indian and therefore love our films, but we're Indian American. And that means that for my parents, for example, when they came here, it was very difficult for them to go home in the first 20 years that they were living in America because it was so expensive. And at that time, it was very difficult to travel internationally. These films were the only sights and sounds that they had of home for years at a time. So they really held a very emotional place in their lives as immigrants.
Give us a sense of the movies and food in your home growing up. Was it the situation where you would have a movie like just streaming or screening in the background while everybody gathered at the table? Or did people sit on the couch with food on their laps and watch?
Well, they are really two separate experiences because Indians take their food very seriously and they take their films very seriously. So you really need to devote and be fully present for both experiences. So growing up in my house, and I'm from a small town in Pennsylvania that was 99% white and Christian, and we were one of the few Indian families in the area. Growing up in my house, there were just a couple of constants, and one was that my mom would prepare a very elaborate Indian home-cooked dinner every night, and we would sit down as a family at 6 o'clock to eat dinner. For us, that was sort of a sacred time around the dinner table, and then there was a follow-up sacred time to that, which was the movie that we would watch after dinner. That was our opportunity to come together as a family and watch these films, which is the way that I, as a kid that was born in America, is the way that I learned about my culture and my heritage. It's the way I learned the language. It's the way that I learned the customs. It's the way that I learned about the music and the dance and the different types of storytelling that my parents grew up with.
What I love about this book is you really go into depth, like a film critic, about the movies. So I'm going to just tell you that last night I went on to YouTube and I watched Door. D-O-R.
Oh, great.
So the food that you chose to pair with Dor was a chicken curry.
Right.
And Brussels sprouts with peanuts, which I thought was really smart because, you know, we're still obsessed with Brussels sprouts here.
Yes. Right.
They won't
exactly.
go away. Mm-hmm. But this is such a different take on them. Tell me a little bit about these two dishes and why sort
sure.
of that movie inspired them.
Sure. So Dor is this beautiful little independent film. Dor means string. And it's the story of two strangers, two women who come from very different walks of life, who are connected to each other through a very dramatic sequence of events. And that's sort of the story, the relationship between these two women as they come together and their lives intersect. The film takes place in the deserts of Rajasthan, which is this beautiful scenic area of India, which is deserts. And I wanted the meal to be rustic in the same way. It should feel very hearty and simple and a humble meal. And the chicken curry recipe that I included in there is sort of the quintessential home-style chicken curry dish. It's the kind of dish that you could make around a campfire in the deserts of Rajasthan. It's the kind of dish that we made in my house growing up in Pennsylvania. Every single Indian household has that classic chicken curry, which is chicken that is braised in some sort of a tomato sauce. And the spices can vary from region to region of India and from family to family. Certainly, everyone has their own version of it. But that's sort of a very hearty, warm, rustic meal that I wanted you to enjoy with this rustic film. And with this chicken curry, I wanted to pair something that was bright and fresh. And that's why I chose the Brussels sprouts.
I have to tell you this one experience, and I feel like your book will short-circuit this for a lot of people, which is just perfect. But I have a friend who used to make fun of me all the time for watching Bollywood movies.
And why is that?
He just didn't get it. And
yeah.
I mean, he had, you know, has a film degree from UCLA, and he just didn't get it.
Those film snobs, yes.
Yeah,
I've,
you know
I've
what
heard,
I mean?
Yes. Uh-huh.
So one day he's at my house, and we're hanging out, and I was in the middle of a movie. And it was one of the movies that has really long sort of standalone musical interludes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I said, just come sit down next to me and I'm going to continue watching. You can do what you want. Within 10 minutes, he was transfixed.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Give us a suggestion from the book that would be Bollywood 101, a movie that's not a cartoon, that shows like a depth of character, but is just super engaging and entertaining.
Bollywood is not just one thing. Bollywood is a lot of different genres, and that is the thing that I try to demonstrate in the book. There are horror films, there are dramas, there are comedies, there are epic period dramas, there are films for kids, and I give you examples of all of those so that you can sort of pick and choose. It's not one size fits all. Different people are going to be drawn to different types of films. One of the films in the book that I would say is a good one to start with is a film called Bajirao Mastani. And that is a historical epic drama that came out, I believe, 2 years ago. And it was directed by a master filmmaker named Sanjay Leela Bhansali, who directed another epic film called Devdas, which is also in the book. And Devdas was the first Bollywood movie to premiere at the Cannes Film Festival. This film is really well done and is a great place to start because it has an excellent story. It's about a kingdom in ancient India and about a soldier, a general who falls in love with a woman but is married to another woman. So it's this epic love triangle. It's dramatic and romantic. It has amazing song and dance numbers. The production values are out of this world in terms of costumes and sets. It's a great story. Priyanka Chopra, who many people may know from Quantico, stars as the wife in this story, so that there's another way in. That's one of the good ways to be introduced to Bollywood, Bajirao Mastani.
And what's the food that you pair with that?
With Bajirao Mastani, I pair a chicken korma, which is a chicken dish that hails from the Mughal Empire. The Mughals were the Muslim rulers that invaded India. And that is sort of the time period of this film, Bajirao Mastani. I wanted to evoke those flavors in the meal. Traditionally, chicken korma is a very rich chicken curry that is made with cream and nuts and raisins. And what I've done with that dish is I've streamlined the recipe and made it a lot healthier and a lot more accessible. accessible for American home cooks. So I use thin-cut chicken breasts, marinate them and grill them very easily, and then on the side, create a cream sauce that's actually made with yogurt. So it's actually very healthy and just as tasty as the traditional version of the recipe.
Sri Rao is the author of Bollywood Kitchen, home-cooked Indian recipes paired with unforgettable Bollywood films. Get that chicken korma recipe, dig in while watching Bajirao Mastani on the Good Food blog. Go to blogs.kcrw.com/goodfood. Next, let's find out what's in season at LA Farmers Markets. That's when the show continues. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. It's time for the Market Report. Let's find out what Laura Avery's shopping for this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. So happy to welcome chef owner Tyler Gugliotta from Barron's 2239 restaurant in Hermosa Beach. And Tyler, you're here at the market. You're looking at the produce. Fall is in the air. Tell us what you're looking for.
There's all kinds of good stuff right now. We got some beautiful honey nut squash over here at Wiser Farms that we're going to focus on today.
And let's describe what a honey nut squash looks like.
Imagine a butternut squash, but much smaller, like a handheld, palm of your hand, but very concentrated flavor. A little easier to peel, a little easier to manage because it is so a little bit smaller, but you will have to, you know, clean four or five in comparison to one big butternut.
But apparently it's worth it because what, of the flavor?
Yeah, I think it's just a higher Brix count, so it just means more like residual sugar in the actual squash itself. Has a really nice kind of velvety texture when it's cooked, and it's pretty versatile.
And being so small, are we talking about a single serving kind of a thing, or are you just put them all together?
They're kind of cute looking, so if you wanted to cut one in half and kind of present the thing as a whole to kind of show the beauty of the actual squash itself, that'd be awesome. But if you wanted to cut up into more chunks or turn into a puree or a soup, that's the great thing about it. So you can so many uses for it.
And of course, you chefs are always looking for something new and, you know, something to put on the menu that nobody else might have yet.
Of course, yeah, especially going into like the fall winter season where you kind of like you're inundated with squash and pumpkin and all that kind of stuff. So it's nice to have a couple options other than a straight butternut or a common pumpkin or something like that.
Right, and all the kabochas and those big Tahitians and everything else. But it is squash season, so what recipe are you planning to do with it?
A lot of people, when they think squash, think of like some of the classic flavors that you associate with, like sage and brown butter, which is awesome. So maybe do like a filled pasta of some kind, like a tortellini, or since it is so sweet, to kind of contrast the sweetness of the squash, toss it with some kind of chili, finish it with some kind of like an acid, whether it be a vinegar or some lime juice, maybe incorporate that into like a grain salad.
So if you're doing it like in a salad, are you peeling it, dicing it, roasting it, and then putting it in the salad?
You have a couple options there. I would peel it, dice it, and you could either simmer it in with some salted water until it's slightly tender, or you can do a little 50-50 and kind of slightly cook it in water and then shock it. And then when you're ready to serve it, cut off some cooking time, you could throw it go into a hot pan or into a hot oven and kind of roast it like that. Or you can roast it from raw. And you gotta kind of get a slightly different result from each cooking method, which is cool.
Yeah, and then I can imagine a great soup and everything else you do with this squash, so creamy.
Yeah, actually, really nice texture, and like, yeah, puree is so smooth. It has a really, like, velvety mouthfeel, yeah.
Yeah, sounds so good. All right, so great. Squash season, fall is here. We got Halloween, we got Thanksgiving, we got Christmas, we have, you know, the winter, the cold months, so good time to turn on the oven and do some roasting and try these squash. That was chef owner Tyler Gugliotta from Barron's 2239 Restaurant in Hermosa Beach. We love it when the South Bay chefs come up here and walk around the market and enjoy and run into other South Bay chefs who come up here all the time. So it's always great to have them. We love these recipes. I'm talking now with Alex Weiser. He's at many markets around here in Southern California. And Alex is the one who grows those little honey nut squash. And you're the only one, and you kind of came across it almost by happenstance.
Yes, well, I got the seed originally from a professor at UCLA, Professor James Bassett, and he knows what we do. We grow for flavor and uniqueness, and he read about some trials they're doing at Cornell University, breeding vegetables for for flavor and uniqueness and for grower friendliness also.
Also for the small farmer. It isn't for industrial, right, it's right. for you guys.
It's for small farms,
right.
particularly in New England, because yeah. that's where they're located. But in searching for unique varieties, I'm looking not only what is right. here in California, but what's growing across the country. So I read about it and loved it.
Well, you you read the back of the seed packet.
True. And then I Googled and went online and read that there was something on Savoir magazine. I read the story that Dan Barber from Blue Hill and Stone Barns was part of this program.
That's in New York State.
In New York. Right. And that this squash had double the sweetness, brighter, deeper orange color, higher in beta carotene. It was grower friendly, resistant to powdery mildew. It was just like 10 great things about this squash. And they're cute. The size of your palm. So they make a beautiful presentation, a single serving. And it's open pollinated.
Explain what that means.
That means the seed from the squash you can save for the next year, which, you know, big seed companies don't like that. They don't want to produce open pollinated seeds. They want to produce certain hybrids where you only can get the seed from them.
Right.
We still buy more seed, but we save a lot of our own seed. Some of the chefs have given me back seed.
Well, how many seasons have you grown it?
Well, last year was the first year.
I snuck it in,
and it caught fire quickly, and I went, oh, this is going to be big. But I didn't want to talk about it too much because we only had so much. So this was the year I really ramped up. And it won't be long that I don't know if I'm the only, we are the only farmers, but we're catching the trend first, and I'm sure they're going to be grown everywhere soon because they're so great.
Well, are you gonna now maybe next year try to do some of your seed and some of the company seed and have like a contest?
Totally. Yeah. I want to. Whatever we plant, we always mark on stakes like where the seed came from.
Yeah.
So I'll buy from the seed company that I bought from last year, but also then use my own seed that we saved and mark it in the field and see if there's any differences. Maybe ours, where we save the seed, will be more acclimated to our area. We'll see the results. It should be the same. We're always looking at doing trials. I'm always seeing what's going on at Cornell University, as well as here in California, UC Davis. We do a lot of trials. That's how we discovered the Magic Myrna potato. It's doing trials and looking for flavor, number one, uniqueness. And that's one of the great things about being a part of this market is we get feedback from the best palates in the country right here. It's like a research project. We grow it, we bring it to the tastemakers and get feedback. And when we know we have their thumbs up, then I know we're onto something and then we go bigger the following year. It's fun.
All right, well, good. You know, I think everybody now can't wait to taste these and then get those little seeds out and realize how precious they are when you're holding these seeds, which is growing this wonderful new crop that we now know about. So thank you, Alex.
My pleasure.
Farmers like you who do stuff like this, we appreciate you so much.
Oh, well, thank you.
That was farmer Alex Weiser. He farms in Tehachapi and also in Lucerne up in the high desert. He's got interesting varieties always on his table, not to mention his interesting salespeople that you can come and talk to. And we love everything he does. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Now let's travel to the Caucasus region, to Georgia. Carla Capalbo calls it the birthplace of wine because for 8,000 years, wine's been made there in large terracotta pots which are buried underground. Capalbo writes about the wine, their unique vessels, and food, of course, in a new book called Tasting Georgia.
The idea behind this is that these vessels were only ever used for actual winemaking. They weren't used, like amphorae, for transporting the wine.
And can you tell us what those vats are called?
Yes, they're called kvevri, and that's spelled Q-V-E-V-R-I, and it's the Georgian name for these enormous terracotta vessels. The interesting thing about kvevri is that they have pointed bottoms, so you have to imagine an enormous egg shape with a pointed bottom.
And it seems from the book that nearly every family has a cellar with many of these embedded in the earth.
That's exactly right. And in fact, it's interesting you should say that because their idea for it is that it's almost like the kvevri, and therefore the wine, are made in what they call the mother's embrace, the earth's embrace, so that they stay at a constant earth temperature. And this particular tradition was discouraged during the long Soviet occupation of Georgia. And it's having an extraordinary rebirth now, thank goodness, because it was being kept alive, as you say, by everybody's families in the country.
Yeah, I think the first interview I did with a local wine shop owner about Georgian wine was maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and it was just so niche. And now it just seems that there's such an interest on, quote, natural wines and orange wines. And it seems that maybe Georgia has been a driving force in this new interest.
I think that's exactly right. And as much as it is a driving force, it's also the birthplace. So people are kind of going back to the beginning. And when you go back to the beginning, you have to go to Georgia. And that's why I first went there, because I had gotten to know a winemaker in northeastern Italy in my last book, in the Collio book, who's called Josko Gravner. And Gravner was the first non-Georgian, as far as I know, to throw away his barrels and to make this, at that time, revolutionary decision to bury his wines. And everybody at the time thought he was completely out of his mind. But it's true that recently, in the last sort of 10 years or so, the natural, so-called natural wine movement has been gaining force. And what's really exciting, though, is that you go to Georgia because you're interested in that, and then you discover that there's this whole other thing going on in Georgia which just makes you fall in love. And it's to do with the food, the feasting traditions, and also the music, the incredible polyphonic music, and the Georgian sense of hospitality.
Yeah, I mean, we could spend all the time we have today talking about wine, but I really do want to get into these other elements. Sketch for us where Georgia sits in that area called the Caucasus, and why has it been so strategically important?
It's positioned south of Russia, north of eastern Turkey and Armenia, and to its east it has Azerbaijan, and then to the west it has the Black Sea. So it even has a bit of this coastline, which, again, was very attractive to people coming from the north because it was like a kind of Riviera. And it's warm enough to grow a lot of things that really can't be grown further north or further south because it begins to get too hot. So the climate for grapes is perfect, but also lots of fruits and vegetables, and their cuisine is incredibly rich with vegetables and also walnuts, which play a central part in their cooking.
So walnuts. Talk about walnuts and how they're used. They're ubiquitous.
Yes, walnuts appear, I would say, in every meal in Georgia in some way. But they're usually crushed. And what's really interesting is that, you know, the kitchens that I was visiting in these country houses or little farmhouses sometimes were very, very simple by our standards. Most, or many anyway, of the women that I visited cooking had no running water in their houses. They would, you know, go out into the garden and there'd be a well, or their son would go and pump the water for them. However, this does not stop them from producing the most incredibly sort of sophisticated flavors and combinations of flavors. And the walnut is a central source not only of protein, but sometimes of a kind of oiliness in a good sense, because the walnuts there are actually quite different from, let's say, the Californian walnuts, because I've tried cooking these dishes with both, because whenever I come back from Georgia, I always bring a big suitcase full of walnuts back to London, where we are allowed to. What they do, though, there, most families still traditionally pound the walnuts in a pestle and mortar, and that kind of extracts, it sort of squeezes out this wonderful sort of nut brown oil, and they sort of set a few little drops of it apart and then maybe just top up a stew with that or use it in a soup, and it adds an extra dimension of the flavor. They pound the walnuts with just a few spices. What I love about Georgian cuisine is that it is distinctive in its flavors, and yet there's nothing that really overpowers it. So the three main spices that they use are very, very small aromatic coriander seeds, which are easy to find everywhere, but I have to say the Georgian ones I like the best, and ground blue fenugreek, which again is quite simple to find here if you go to a spice shop or even online. And then the third thing they use, which is strange in a way for us because we see it growing everywhere, and yet no one really here thinks of doing anything comestible with it or edible, and that's the so-called French marigold, the sort of one that looks like a pom-pom. What they do is that they dry the petals and grind it into what they call saffron. But in fact, it's not saffron as we know it from the crocus. This is just something that's a beautiful bright orange. It's a very subtle flavor, but it gives a little bit of a sort of warmer tone to the dishes. And sometimes they even use a few of the leaves from that same plant, which are very aromatic if you've ever smelled them in your garden.
And I have to say, just from the photographs in the book, the landscape is just breathtaking. There are mountains and there's valleys. It seems to be a lot of green vineyards everywhere. It's something that we would recognize from traveling in the Mediterranean, yet there's also an otherness and a simplicity of it due to lack of development that seems very engaging and appealing to many of us at this point.
Yes, well, I mean, for me, one of the key aspects that I sort of immediately was excited by in Georgia was what I suppose we would call animal husbandry. So animals are free in Georgia. You know, they're not living in jails the way they so often are in the Western world. And consequently, they are actually allowed to be as intelligent as they are. And, you know, I've often wandered through streets in the countryside in Georgia and found, you know, cows sleeping on the white lines in the road in the middle of the afternoon because there are fewer insects there than there are in the greener patches. But the animals are free in the day. They are released from their safe havens in someone's barn or garden in the nighttime where they're kept safely, and they go off on their own all day. They just wander. And this is true of cows. It's true of pigs. It changes the whole quality, not only of the countryside, but actually also of the flavors in the food, because they're not going to kill, you know, a one-year-old cow. It wouldn't make sense. That cow has still got a long life in front of it. And so when you finally do slaughter the animals, the meat may be a bit tougher, but it has so much more flavor. And that goes with plums. There are both domesticated plums there and there are wild plums. They're these little sour green plums. And one of their most famous condiments is a green sour plum sauce called tikkamali. This sauce, which is made with garlic and fresh herbs, and those spices that I was mentioning before, coriander seed or fenugreek, is used not only as a condiment, almost like a ketchup that you could just add to your dishes, but you actually can stir it into stews because the Georgians love very much that acidity, that they always want their dishes to have a sort of higher note, if you like, of sort of very bright acidity that you get from these sour plums.
One of the things that's interesting to me is that they use these plums for sourness when they have all that wine. So you would think that there would be a huge use of vinegar.
Interestingly enough, they have less of a culture of vinegar in terms of, let's say, pickling than they do of fermenting. They do a tremendous amount of fermentation as a means of preserving food, but mostly without the use of vinegar. And so they will salt their ingredients and ferment them that way. But there's a particular thing that I love very much in Georgian. It's called jonjoli. And jonjoli are the blossoms, the little sort of buds. Think of something like lilac before it really opens. And they pick them more or less at that stage before the little flowers are open because they don't want any insects to go inside. And they salt them. And it's in fact the bladder nut bush. And that fermented blossom, and they also sometimes substitute it with acacia blossom, is used as, again, a kind of counterpoint to the stewed beans that they eat a lot of. I mean, again, it's something that sort of fits right into today's eating for some people, because a lot of the food at the Georgian feast, where they lay out many, many dishes at a time, you don't eat them just one at a time, as we might. You might sit down at a supra, which is the feast, the supra table will already be laden with different dishes of food and of maybe 5, 6, 7, 8 different kinds of dishes. And in that mix, there will always be some what we now call vegan dishes because as part of the Orthodox Christian religion, there are many fasting days during not only the year, but also during the week, like Wednesdays and Fridays. So it could easily be that sitting at your table, your guests, there'll be 3 or 4 people who might that day not be eating dairy or meat. And so they'll always find something to eat at the Georgian table. And that includes the beans. It includes all of these fermented foods. They ferment whole heads of garlic, green tomatoes, little chili peppers, all sorts of wonderful things.
The women that you have profiled in your book, the photographs of them sometimes being just pensive over a table that's already been plundered, or stretching out just super thin dough, or struggling with these kind of stringy, sticky mixtures of potatoes and cheese are fabulous. Is this kind of traditional cooking still sort of organically being passed down generation to generation?
I think that's absolutely right. Yes, it is. And, you know, there's a very interesting thing I was told at the beginning of my sort of journeying and photographing, because I also took the photographs in Georgia. And they say that for the Georgians, the guest is a gift from God, and particularly, obviously, a guest who comes in peace. They feel really that at a super table, the feasting table, which, by the way, they can throw together, you know, from I don't know how, and just from nothing in no time at all if a guest happens to drop by, because they would, again, never serve their guests just one dish when they could serve them five or ten. And the guest sort of completes the table. For the Georgians, if there is no guest at the table, it feels kind of barren in some way, you know, incomplete.
So let's focus just a little bit on a couple of food items. There's so many and they're so diverse. But one thing that really caught my eye, given that I love the ingenuity of making something from nothing, is there's a noodle dish that uses the dough of the noodle in two different ways and then is combined with the pasta water and yogurt in a soup.
Yes, okay, this is it's a dish called tutmaji, and I only found it down in the south. So we're talking about a semi-mountainous region that's on the border with Turkey and Armenia, and it was an area that was under Ottoman rule for three centuries in its earlier history. And I can't say that it maybe is a food that everybody will absolutely adore when they eat it, because we might find it, for our taste, somewhat bland. But again, you always have to think that even a bland dish in the Georgian table will be countered by something spicy or something sour or something sweet. You know, I had an Italian grandmother who made noodles, i.e. pasta, just from flour and water. And so this woman did that. But then she took a little bundle of that pasta that she'd made and she rolled it out into ropes and cut it into little, almost like little baby gnocchi. And then she sautéed them in butter and then stirred those. They become almost crunchy. And then she stirred those into the soup and added a bit of her own, of course, homemade yogurt and some very, very, very slowly, almost meltingly sautéed onions that she had done, again, in lots of their delicious clarified butter. So it was a very unusual dish. It was a dish that I thought was quite wonderful. But again, it worked best, you know, in conjunction with the other dishes that she had at that table.
Carla Capalbo is the author of Tasting Georgia, A Food and Wine Journey in the Caucasus. If you were to add air to that wine we were just talking about, along with bacteria, you'd have vinegar. Next on the show, we're going to learn how to make vinegar at home. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and you're listening to Good Food on KCRW.
If you have an herb garden or if you have flavors that you personally really like, if you like things that are spicy, infusing vinegar with hot peppers, whether those are fresh or dried, is a wonderful way to get that flavor into your food without necessarily adding the vegetable or the herb in directly.
That's Harry Rosenblum. He's part owner of the specialty shop Brooklyn Kitchen and is a walking encyclopedia for how to make vinegar at home. So why don't you take us through the process?
Sure. So vinegar is a very simple process. It is the secondary fermentation of any alcohol that you could make or that someone else has already made for you. So let's say you started out with wine and you wanted to make red wine vinegar. If you had a wine that you drink a lot and you really like it, you would essentially take that. You would expose it to air in an open-top jar. I like to use a quart size or half-gallon size mason jar. And you would inoculate it with some living bacteria of vinegar. And any raw or unpasteurized vinegar will have living bacteria in it. And it is that bacteria, called Acetobacter, that converts the alcohol in that beverage, in the wine or whatever you're starting from, into acetic acid, which is what we know of as vinegar.
And that's it. There's no futzing around. We don't have to add anything or buy something special.
You don't. I recommend that you water down your alcoholic starting point to below 9% ABV. So if you're starting with a big Tuscan Red or something like that, you might want to water it down almost by half just to get the alcohol level a little bit lower. The bacteria don't seem to like a super high alcohol. It slows them down a little bit. And really, they do all the work. It's just time. Takes usually, depending on environmental factors, where you're keeping the jar, if you're keeping it in your kitchen, depending how warm or cool it is, what time of year, how much humidity, it can take as little as 3 weeks to convert and as long as 2.5 months or so.
Yeah, I find here in Los Angeles lately, it's been taking less than a month. It's so fast.
Yeah, in the summer in New York, I find it's pretty quick.
So the thing that starts to form at the top of the liquid, what is that called?
So we call that the mother of vinegar. I love the analogy that it is somehow birthing the vinegar for us and that I have mothers that are descendant from previous mothers. It's really just a cellulose byproduct of the bacteria converting the alcohol. It does contain the bacteria. What I like to remind people is that as humans, we really like a physical manifestation of things we can't see. So we can't see the bacteria, which are also present in liquid of that living vinegar. But the mother reminds us and lets us know that they're there and they're working hard and they're converting all the alcohol for us.
So let's get to flavor, because after all, that's what this is all about. If I have, let's just say, a homemade vinegar that I've made using a moderately priced full-bodied red wine vinegar, contrast it with what the vinegar is that I could get in the supermarket.
So I think everyone who's listening will know if you say, you know, think about what vinegar smells like, everyone's going to know what that smell is like. And that's because we're familiar with white distilled vinegar. And the only thing in white distilled vinegar is acetic acid. That's it. So that's the smell of pure vinegar. And most commercial, cheap red wine vinegars, the last time I was in the supermarket, yesterday I took a look and I think about a liter of the cheapest red wine vinegar I saw was about $1.50. That is really just going to smell and taste like that acetic acid, like white distilled vinegar that's got, you know, maybe a tiny bit of red color in it because they probably added some wine at some point. Contrasting that to what you can make at home, your homemade vinegar from a full-bodied red wine is going to be full of flavor. It's still going to taste like the wine, so you're going to taste grape notes. If the wine was fruity, you'll taste the cherry in there. You might taste the pepperiness in there, except that it just will be converted and it will be more acidic. And you might taste a little bit of the acetic acid, but the thing that I find so wonderful about making homemade vinegars is that the flavor possibilities are just endless. And really, we're not just talking about the flavor of that acetic acid. We're talking about the flavor of a delicious beer that you started with or the flavor of a hard cider.
So talk to me a bit about that delicious beer, because I know that's what got you hooked, right?
Absolutely. So the opportunities, I think, for the home vinegar maker are just incredible with the amount of and the explosion of craft breweries in this country. You've got cream ales, you've got IPAs, you've got stouts, you've got brown ales, you've got porters, and you have all these different flavor profiles. Each one of those beers will yield a different vinegar that has some of those flavors that come through. One of my favorite anecdotes about it is years ago, I made a batch of vinegar with a very early version of Brooklyn Brewery's summer ale. And that particular beer is very citrusy on the nose and on the palate, but it's not very acidic. So you have the sort of flavors of citrus, but you don't have the high acid content. And if you take a beer like that and you convert the alcohol that's in there into acetic acid, suddenly when you pour a splash of that into a glass of seltzer, it tastes like delicious citrus, some kind of a, you know, lemon, orange, lime mixture, but it's coming from a beer.
So let's talk about cocktails. What's your favorite cocktail that calls for vinegar?
Well, there are two in my book that I would say are my favorites. One is a mint julep that actually you make a mint shrub first. So you infuse mint and sugar into vinegar, and then you use that in the mint julep with the bourbon. And I just love the added acid. I mean, obviously, I wrote a book about vinegar, so I'm no stranger to consuming it all the time. But that one I absolutely love. I'm not big on sweet. And so I often find that drinks like an old-fashioned or like a mint julep sometimes end up too sweet for me. So adding the acid in there helps to balance the sweet. And then the other one is I have a play on a gin fizz in there. Essentially, you can take any shrub. In the book, there's a recipe for a strawberry rhubarb shrub that's delicious in this drink, or a blueberry shrub that's delicious in this drink. But you mix a little bit of shrub with some gin and egg white, and you shake it to aerate the egg white. And then you add a little bit of seltzer on top at the end over ice. And the mouthfeel and just the smoothness that comes from using egg white in that drink, I love.
Okay, I'm going to have to try that one. Here at Good Food, we're all about the pie. And I know you have a vinegar pie in your book. Where did you first find the recipe?
I first encountered vinegar pie in one of the Laura Ingalls Wilder books. A number of years ago, I was reading all of them to my daughter. And they talk about having run out of flavorings for pie. And so they use vinegar to flavor essentially a custard pie. The vinegar pie ends up being very similar to something like a key lime pie, but instead of lime, you're using vinegar to get that flavor.
Harry Rosenblum is the author of the book Vinegar Revival, Artisanal Recipes for Brightening Dishes and Drinks. He's not the only one trying to spread the vinegar gospel. Michael Harlan Turkell wrote the book Acid Trip, Travels in the World of Vinegar. It's a more complex look at the marvelous stuff. I called him up for a history lesson on vinegar production. How far back does vinegar go?
Well, it probably comes right after the history of beer and or wine, because in how vinegar is made, it can be made from an alcohol. It's the second fermentation of that. So it's literally, I think, minutes, if not hours, if not days, after the invention of wine, which can be traced back probably to Babylonia. Along the Tigris and Euphrates River, where modern-day Baghdad, Iraq is, there were all these bountiful fruits from pomegranates, figs, full of juice and sap, and that saccharine sugar would then convert very easily in alcohol, and because there wasn't refrigeration, would thusly become vinegar even quicker.
What's fascinating to me about Acid Trip, your book, is that unlike many other vinegar guides, which tell you to get a mother, and which is what I've been doing for years, you have a completely different method of starting your vinegar that begins with source material. Can you take me through your philosophy of vinegar making and how it pairs with your obsession with quality and food in general?
Absolutely. You know, there are about 10 to 12 pages dedicated in the back of the book, and there is only one master recipe to make vinegar, and it's written more as a theoretical equation than it is a recipe. I believe vinegar can be made from a lot of things that we don't normally make vinegar from. If you track back from alcohol, that has to be a sugar first. And even before that, a starch can be converted into a sugar. So you look around you and you see starches and grains and sugar cane and wheats and barley. That can all eventually become a vinegar. So I kind of set up these variables and controls that you have to guide your vinegar along on. You want a little bit of sugar here. You want a little bit of alcohol here. You can adjust with water. But it's about guiding whatever ingredient that is to its best product at the end. And with that, I kind of want to dispel the preconception that vinegar is made out of bad stuff. You know, it's not sour wine, even though the French root kind of comes from that. It can be made up of great ingredients. And some of the best vinegars I've had around the world are from spectacular produce.
Let's talk about Japan. You describe the experience that you had with Akihiro Ilio and Ilio Jozo. Could you talk about just the whole situation there?
I mean, when I initially got there, I thought it was going to be easy to find vinegar makers. It was harder than I thought. And I kind of had to dig around, especially trying to find this canon of who I thought was going to be there, and luckily found Ilio Jozo. Akihiro, I think, is maybe the fourth generation. He's baby face, looked like he's just graduated college and has that gusto with him too. But he's been making these vinegars mainly from rice. And let me note that he's the only person that I met in Japan that grows his own rice to brew his own sake to make his own vinegar. So that whole cycle just kind of blew my mind.
Which one of the reasons why I wanted you to share stories about him was because he seems like he's the perfect person to take this idea of starting from source material to end up with this sour ingredient.
Absolutely. You know, vinegar is an agricultural product. And I think, you know, you can go to a vineyard and see wine being grown, but you're not going to go to a vinegar factory and, you know, see that source material right there, aside from maybe Modena and Reggio Emilia, where you can see Lambrusco grapes being grown. But there in Miyazu, you know, a few hours north of Kyoto on the Sea of Japan, there was a rice field and there was a sake factory. And that was all to make the most beautiful rice vinegar I've ever had in my life. And it is that care about ingredient and that quality throughout all the processes, rather than just saying, well, it's going to turn into vinegar anyway, that made his product one of the best I've ever tasted.
Can you describe it for us, the difference between that rice vinegar and the kind that we get in the bottle that everybody has?
Yeah, the rice vinegar in this country that I've tasted, it feels like a gut punch. It feels like acetone. It makes you cough. This has some roundness, has some body, in the same way that when you start kind of diving into the world of sake, you see that there's expression. You see that there's terroir. I know that's a term that's used for a lot of things that aren't French or aren't wine, but you know where this rice vinegar came from and inherently what the product is. And it's just singular. I mean, I could probably taste it in a blind tasting and tell you this is Iojozo.
You also mentioned that you can start with starch that converts to sugar, and they make a purple yam vinegar.
Yeah, purple potato vinegar. It was wild. It's that purple that you see from, like, the Minnesota Vikings kind of purple. I mean, it's so deep. It's so vibrant. I climbed up to the top of the still, and they lifted the cover, and I saw it, and I smelled it, and it was like juicy Gamay. It was like Beaujolais. It was like one of the best wines I ever smelled, but it was these starchy purple potatoes. And they cook them, they steam them, and those starches then convert into sugar, and they make a sweet potato wine and then convert that into vinegar. And I know that took some of the, you know, poetry out of it by explaining it like that, but when you taste Benamosu, especially on a scoop of vanilla ice cream, it is life-altering.
Is it comparable to the best balsamic vinegars?
Balsamic. How do I explain this? I mean, I didn't want to write a book about balsamic, but I knew I had to have it in a vinegar book. But it's an outlier to what vinegars are. Most vinegars are made from great source material, like we had mentioned, but balsamic is cooked down must. It's not what the pure ingredient was.
Yeah, it's a syrup.
Yeah.
They basically create a syrup.
Yeah.
And then the wood is an ingredient.
That's true. And I see some other barrel-aged methods, but yeah, the batteria in balsamic is certainly part of the nuance and structure of what balsamic becomes.
Aside from that Japanese experience, where else in the world did you go that just blew your mind? It made you want to come back and try and see if you could do it yourself.
Well, that's Vienna for me. I am 15 years removed from an experience that made me who I am today and set me on this path of acidity. And it was at Number 9 Park in Boston, Massachusetts. I was lucky enough to be a photographer in Barbara Lynch's kitchen. She gave me this cap full of, I didn't know what it was at the time, and just told me to, you know, shoot it back. And you listen to Barbara. And I did that, and I had this kind of quizzical face on. And again, it was like one of these instances in my life where my palate and everything about me changed forever. And I kind of had that flavor memory on the back burner for a long time. 15 years later, I found myself in Vienna at Erwin Gegenbauer's house, who I still think is quite possibly the best vinegar maker in the world. And that's not to say that other people aren't great vinegar makers, but he was the one. He was the first one that kind of set me on this course.
I had one of those experiences. I mean, I think it was the second Slow Food Salone del Gusto that ever was. And I had the opportunity to taste some of those vinegars. Truly extraordinary.
Yeah, and he has hundreds of different kinds. I mean, the varieties alone on the shelves are mind-blowing, but they have such purity because they are what they are. They are cucumber, and the only ingredient in there really is cucumber, or red pepper, and saffron. And again, it's like the purity of this vinegar. You taste the pure essence of that beautiful source ingredient.
So how do you go about getting enough saffron, or do you start with the flour?
You know, there are some proprietary things that he didn't quite tell me. And being the vinegar maker that he is and making the product that he does, I'm going to let him have that, and I will constantly buy his saffron vinegar.
So when I was reading the book, I constantly was feeling that if I were already a home brewer, I would be light years ahead in understanding some of the processes to create balanced source material. Is that so?
Yeah, because I was light years behind. Not being a home brewer, I first made vinegar by accidentally leaving a bottle of red wine out. I did the same thing with beer. I had filled a barrel in my backyard, kind of thinking along the same lines of the barrel-age cocktail movement. Or I don't know exactly what I was thinking, but I wanted to see what happened. And that reaction was making one of the best malt or beer vinegars I've ever had in my life. You know, you have fish and chips, and I have an amazing recipe from April Bloomfield in here, which is actually the only recipe in the book that doesn't have vinegar in it. But next to the fish and chips is a bottle of malt vinegar. after tasting that barrel that had been sitting out in my backyard and seeing what could be done with beer, I question, why isn't there better beer vinegar in this country, if not world? We have such a great movement of craft beer. We understand those base ingredients from Bollies and malts so well. We can go a step further.
Before I ended up having a friend of mine who's a forager who makes wild vinegars, starting with foraged materials, before he gave me a piece of his mother, I tried so many times to make vinegar by just letting wine sit out. And it never happened for me. Were there little pixies at your house?
You know, it's a condition of environment. And that's why I give those controls, those variables, because if that environment isn't right, you have to help it along. Having a mother is a pre-existing condition, and I didn't mean to word it like that. The brewer at Martin Pourret, a great vinegar maker in Orléans, France, says, you know, not having a mother is not a malady. Vinegar has been made by non-intervention for years. A mother forms is, it's an indicator that certain things are happening. Too much mother can kind of be like a helicopter mother and smother the substance, the substrate underneath. But, you know, it's this preconception that a mother is not only something that needs to happen, but has some kind of play or role in consistency. I'm going to call a little BS on that. It certainly happens during the vinegar making process, but it might be something that hyper accelerates the process, and it doesn't need to happen. You know, you lose nuance, you lose aroma. That said, I understand, kind of like in the same vein as sourdough starters, there's a story behind having a 100-year-old mother that you've shared in your family, and it does work, and it's so cool that that exists, and I don't want that loss of lineage to happen, but I also want people to know that it's not a necessity.
Michael Harlan Turkel is the author of Acid Trip, Travels in the World of Vinegar. We close out this week's show on an unusual food crawl with our pal Jonathan Gold. That's after this short break. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back to Good Food on KCRW. I'm Evan Kleiman. It's time for our weekly chat with LA Times food critic Jonathan Gold. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi, Evan.
We often go to far-flung places of Los Angeles County, but I believe this might be the farthest we've been to talk about a restaurant.
New Zealand? It's close. We've talked about Australia.
That's true. So you you spent some time this summer in New Zealand.
I did. I spent a couple of weeks there for the, what do they call it? Welly on a Plate.
Oh, I like that.
It's the Wellington Food Festival. It's the capital of New Zealand, way at the bottom of the island.
I know that we've interviewed Ben Schuere before, who was featured in the first season of Chef's Table, I believe. And I understand you ate at his place.
His place is in Melbourne, Australia, and I've eaten there a couple of times, and I think it's one of the great restaurants in the world. One of the things at Attica that I've never seen anywhere else is that there's a National Trust property just a block from his place that they let him use, and it's part of the cook's preparation for the day to go and grow and to harvest the vegetables that they're going to be cooking for the dinner.
That's incredible.
It's something that you wish everyone everywhere were doing in some part.
So what did he do in New Zealand?
He cooked in Wellington for several years at this restaurant called the Ortega Fish Shack, which is more of an elegant restaurant than it seems. He came back to Wellington for the first time in several years to cook a couple days of dinner at the Ortega Fish Shack. And they were extraordinary in ways that I've never seen anywhere else. When he's in Australia, he's obviously exploring like the land and the sea and the terroir and everything there is to do. Here he did it with his native New Zealand, and I think he came up with some stuff that nobody was expecting him to.
Like?
There was a series of small appetizers or snacks at the beginning of the meal. One of them was named after a woman that he used to cook for when she was a cabinet secretary. They were the most white bread sandwiches you can imagine. You know, white bread, mayonnaise, and the local crayfish. On the one hand, it's something that you would be served at a bridge party. And on the other hand, they were so good.
And is that because the quality of the seafood there is just extraordinary?
The quality of the seafood off New Zealand, especially the shellfish, is just without parallel. I mean, the water is so clean and so cold. Another of the dishes were huhu grubs.
What are huhu grubs?
It's this giant maggot, I guess.
Larva?
Larva that, you know, are part of Maori culture. I mean, Maoris have eaten them for millennia.
Are they analogous to witchetty grubs in Australia?
Everybody keeps going back and forth between witchetty grubs. Witchetty grubs, to me, they're much smaller, and to me, they taste like pine nuts. I mean, if somebody didn't tell you you were eating a grub, you probably wouldn't know it. These were bigger, and he toasted them and served them into these holes bored out of the sort of rotten wood that they tend to infest anyway. The presentation was you got a piece of wood with worms sticking out of it, and you picked a worm out of the hole in the wood, and you crunched it, and it was really delicious. And there weren't any left over, which is, you know, a testament to the huhu grub. He did a pie, like a meat pie with mutton bird, which is, again, a kind of native bird. Native birds are very off limits there, except to, you know, certain Maori. As part of that, there was a course that was nothing but absolutely dug that morning potatoes, cooked in a little salt water and dressed with a little bit of yeast. And they were the best potatoes I've ever had. I mean, just the potato-ness of them, the texture of them, you could almost feel like every cell.
Wow, how special.
And it kept going on that way. There was this presentation that looked like a tide pool of shellfish and seaweeds and such. There was a tartare of wild red deer. Again, game is illegal, but the Maoris have sort of an exception to it. There was a version of a hangi, which is the characteristic Maori dish, which is kind of like a pibil. You wrap stuff and you put it in an earth oven and you let it cook and steam forever. And he did it with a kumara, which is the New Zealand sweet potato.
Okay, so this is a really beautiful example of the high end.
Right.
Did you have sort of a peak low end experience?
What I noticed driving around the country is that there's still a lot of the influence of Britain in the 60s and 70s. You know, every town that you go to has a bakery, and they all have the same sort of white breads, and they all have
sausage rolls.
Sausage rolls and delicious little meat pies and things like that, that everywhere you went, there was tea time.
What a fun thing to talk about. Thank you, Jonathan.
Thank you, Effin.
That's Jonathan Gold, Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, talking about a recent food crawl in New Zealand. Text the words good food to 69866 to get Jonathan's weekly restaurant recommendations. That is it for this week's show. If you missed any part of it, you can listen to the show on our website or on KCRW's mobile app. You can also download our show wherever you get your podcasts. As always, so many thanks to the Good Food team, Laurel Garcia, Rosalie Atkinson, Joseph Stone, Joel Stein, Michelle Escobar, and Ronnie Mickelson. I'm Effin Kleiman, and I'll be back next week with more Good Food.